This episode of the Signal 51 Chronicles is brought to you by Oscar's Pub, 6323 Kent Bowie Boulevard.
Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation, a law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. This week on the Signal 51 Chronicles, part two of Massacre at the Den for Thieves. At about 7 a.m. on Monday, May 14th, 1990, three armed and masked men, one in a wolf mask, burst into a small cafe well past its prime. The joint was the Glass Key at 800 Luella Street in Fort Worth, and the men were toting what was described by survivors as, quote, military-type assault weapons. A high-stakes gambling game featuring Robert Austin Satterwhite and Billy Ed Farmer, known as Unc, was in progress with perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars at stake. Inside were about 20 patrons. The gunmen began yelling task force, street lingo for police. And according to the owner, Albert Huey Yu, the gunman also yelled, quote, put your money on the table. Within seconds, the three uninvited men opened fire, killing four people and injuring three others inside. One of the injured was the owner, Huey Yu. Outside, a fourth gunman, who was acting as a lookout, fatally shot and killed a fifth man sitting in the parking lot. The Glass Key Cafe was tucked just blocks from the heart of downtown Fort Worth, and at that very moment, it had been transformed from notable to infamous. The massacre that had taken place inside its walls had gone cold. 1 year later, a few leads here and there, but ultimately nobody had been charged. By now, the story of the infamous shooting at the nondescript cafe was losing steam, but some facts had surfaced. Billy Ed Farmer was known on the street as one of the main gamblers that night. He was a known gambler who always had lots of money. In that May 14th match, Unc was losing big. Information surfaced that he had lost $60,000 in cash. Coincidentally, or not, $60,000 was found on Satterwhite's person at the time of the murder. However, Farmer also owed Satterwhite more than $60,000. That's $60,000 more. Farmer also had an IOU to Satterwhite for another $90,000. Satterwhite's bodyguard, Robert Bluto Tasby, offered some insight to police. Knowing an IOU for $90,000 would need to be repaid, Tasby sent a female companion to collect the money shortly after 6 a.m. This was, after all, not a sanctioned event in Las Vegas or even a friendly card game among friends. These were crooks and gamblers who played for keeps.
I'm not a believer in this coincidence, this female just going to get the $90,000 cash. There's a side of me that says, hey, maybe she's the one calling these gunmen. Maybe she's the one going to get these gunmen. And we're not talking about $900. We're talking about $90,000. $180,000 by today's standards-ish.
Yeah, something like that. Well, I also have to wonder, you know, our man Satterwhite just sat there very calmly as they walked in.
Oh, he was cocky.
Or did he send him in?
Or did he send him in? That's a good point. Maybe things went afoul. That's happened
a bunch of times, and again, like we're saying, we're dealing with crooks and gamblers here.
Yeah. Well, you
dealing with other crooks. So if you hire somebody, those gunmen might have just figured, this is our opportunity to get really rich right here.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what happened. But regardless, at 7 a.m., Satterwhite was tired. He'd been playing dice for, I don't know, what, the better part of 8 hours? Long, long dice game. He got so tired, he called for the house rules, which I thought were funny.
Well, what are those house rules?
So the glass key was kind of a dusk to dawn operation. Basically, the games were to end at dawn. And that's...
So, and we must say that you, Jake White, has used his network of law enforcement officers within the city, current and past, active and retired, who worked this case or knew about the case intimately.
Yeah.
Well, the game did not end soon enough. Maybe it was the last few rounds that gave the assailants time. Maybe it was the fact that the female associate of Unk, who knew the game was still ongoing. But regardless, the robbery was underway. The first assailant in was wearing a wolf mask and carrying a military-style rifle. That gunman became known as the Wolfman. He yelled, quote, "Put your money on the table," and fired around in the air. Everyone there hit the ground except one. That was Austin Satterwhite, who earned the nickname Austin through his hometown. Austin, perhaps with the false protection of the bulletproof vest, he stayed in his chair. The vest served no purpose. The Wolfman, only feet from Satterwhite, shot him in the face just below the right eye. When Satterwhite collapsed, he did so carrying over $60,000 on his person. The second gunman circled the table, scooping the loot in a black plastic bag. The Wolfman circled the table and continued killing. Joe Wafers died from a single shot in the bald spot of his head. James Lacey, a fan of the pork chops and dice games, was shot twice in the head. He had arrived only minutes earlier. Timothy Fruity Carter, shot in the arm and the bullet piercing his chest.
What about Farmer? He was in there.
Farmer's luck turned around. Down big, as much as, or, well, close to $150,000 at least.
Yeah, $150,000.
He survived by hiding under the table.
The fact him hiding under the table, the female associate or companion going to get money, the fact he's a well-known gambler, and he survives?
Indeed.
I don't know. Almost 2 years later, January 31st, 1992, federal agents arrested 9 people related to a drug conspiracy investigation. The kingpin in this case was Willie Morris, nickname Boot Nose.
Interesting nickname.
I believe that name came from him stomping his boot into a person's nose, as the story goes.
Okay.
From what I've heard over the years. I don't know if that's factual. Morris, he's well known to the police. He was described as a high-stakes gambler and a drug dealer who set up a drug network stretching from Fort Worth to Houston. Morris, he'd already been charged in an execution-style shooting of a Fort Worth man who owed him a mere $200 for a previous drug deal.
That means business at $200. But this Morris character sounds like he would have run in the same circles as our antagonists, Satterwhite and Farmer. No?
A little closer than just running in the same circle. Farmer was Morris's uncle.
Uh-huh.
And co-defendant in this drug conspiracy case.
All right.
So Unk, in this case, is a drug conspiracy case. Farmer, Morris, related. Uncle, nephew, a.k.a. Unk. That's where that comes from. Short for uncle,
mm-hmm.
in case you were wondering.
Mm-hmm.
So the arrests in this investigation were pursuant to a one-year investigation where investigators linked almost 300 pounds of cocaine being shipped to Fort Worth from Miami and distributed on the streets of Fort Worth.
All right. You've been in narcotics. 300 pounds of cocaine is a buttload.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a... That.
What's the street value on that today, do you think?
You're asking me to do quick math. I'm going to go... I'm going to guesstimate 25 to 30,000. Let's say 30,000... times 150. You do the math. 4.5 million? Does that sound right?
Wow.
30,000 times 150.
4.5 million.
See how quick that was? I did that in my head too, man. That was pretty impressive. So yeah, that's a lot. I mean, not drugs have changed. I mean, we don't see like cocaine at that level, not even anywhere close to it anymore. Meth and fentanyl have
taken it over.
They've taken it over. So I mean, there's still cocaine out there, just nowhere at the level it is or that it was back then.
But this guy, obviously at 300 pounds and that kind of money, was big time in the drug trade.
He was. And here's why it's interesting to the Glass Key Slayings. So Unk Farmer, if he knew anything about this Glass Key Slaying, minus him being the kingpin or the brains behind the slayings, it would have been the time to talk. And the reality is, the streets talk. Mm-hmm. I can promise you, Farmer had an idea of who was responsible, if he wasn't responsible. But 7 months later, Farmer's case and that drug conspiracy case or drug conspiracy investigation, dismissed. So starting to have the writing on the wall, like, hey, maybe he said something. Maybe he provided some information. No. Federal judge Terry Means dismissed the case against Farmer. Farmer's attorney, the late Jim Shaw, who, by the way, I was always petrified of in my time.
Mm-hmm.
He was...
Go ahead and explain that.
I don't know if he... I'm not going to say a name in this. This will give you a test of his character. One of the... hands down, one of the best investigators I ever worked with. Often testified as an expert witness in trials here. Very, very hard worker. He's in court one day. He steps on the elevator and he sees Mr. Shaw on the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks in, and this investigator is just he's a nice guy. Country accent, nice guy. So he thinks, maybe this is all an act in the courtroom when Jim Shaw is tearing me apart. Maybe outside of the courtroom, he's a nice guy. So investigator steps on the elevator and greets Jim Shaw with, hello, Mr. Shaw, how are you? And he said, well, well, if it ain't blank blank, the DA's golden boy. And just turned his back and ignored him the rest of the ride up or down the elevator. I guess it wasn't for show. He wasn't always the friendliest, but so.
Well, I suppose by doing that, he always had an edge on him if you ever did see him again on the, on the stand.
Oh yeah. Get some, he's already on his toes, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly.
Got him, gets him all nervous
in his head.
In his head. So Shaw gets this case against Farmer dismissed. And ultimately what happened, a new witness came forward that could exonerate Farmer. The witness did, in fact, do just that. So here we are, an opportunity to get some viable information about the Glass Key. In theory, Unk had two choices. He could abide by that code on the street and not snitch, which maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Or maybe he didn't know anything about it. But regardless, here we are, another dead end, January, March, April, May of 1992.
So in 1992, the Glass Key Slayings were still cold. Time was moving on. Bill Clinton was about to become president. And the longer it goes, the harder it is to solve. Any police officer and detective will tell you that, right?
Yes.
Year after year, leads would trickle in, but not a single arrest. Not until 5 years after the murders did police develop a viable lead. In March 1995, a witness seemed ready to talk. That witness was described as an FBI informant. Like so many cases, once a suspect knows the long arm of the feds is within reach of them, they are ready to talk. This so-described FBI informant was ready to provide information on this infamous five-year-old case.
So by April of 1996... Fort Worth PD homicide detectives Bocher and Thornton took a road trip around Texas prisons.
All right, so wait, 1 year later?
1 year later. It does seem like a long time, but we don't know how much information was provided, number one. Number two, remember this case? It's now a cold case. Back then, 1996, there's 9, maybe 10 detectives who work all of the homicides in Fort Worth.
Okay, so that's compared to how many today?
Probably not significantly more.
Okay.
Maybe it's double, I don't know, but not a huge increase. They had no cold case detectives. There was, and I suppose they're still an understaffed unit. So these detectives back then, they had to prioritize. What is happening in the here and now is what they had to focus on. So a year seems like a long time. No doubt about it. But like I said, we don't know how much evidence was provided. We don't know. The murders had started to decline, but they're still an understaffed unit. They don't have the luxury like we have now where you can, in essence, Google your investigation. I don't want to downplay it, but the idea of computer research was minimal at best. So Bocher and Thornton are taking a road trip. They had an agenda of six people they wanted to interview. All six were incarcerated at different prisons or jails scattered throughout Texas. The first five to be interviewed, they were witnesses, maybe suspects. We're going to find out. First stop, Denton County Jail was the site of their first interview. When they arrived, they found the inmate had been transported to a Texas prison northwest of Palestine, Texas.
Now that alone tells you how little access they had to computer stuff, because they didn't even know he was in Palestine.
We're
going
to get to that. I think there's a reason for that.
All right.
Possibly. Next on the list, they go to the Robertson unit, a Texas prison in Abilene. They were able to interview two of the three prisoners on day one. They returned the next day only to find the third inmate had been transferred. So right now they're batting 500.
Right. So yeah. It seemed like they would know all this before they started their trip. What's up?
So again, 1996, no internet, no way to verify who is where unless you call, right? That's the only way they're going to know where these inmates are. Hey, are they going to get released? Well,
that seems like, Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark type stuff. It's just so long ago.
So it's just so long ago. Like you, some of our listeners may have heard, not all prison employees, like any other industry, not all of them are on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
So in a prolific case like this Glass Key Slayings, I think they didn't want to risk tipping these guys off, because the inmates are going to find out, possibly, hey, there's some detectives from Fort Worth coming over to talk to you. Now, if you're involved in the Glass Key murders, albeit 6 years ago, that's still got to be in the back of your mind. Why are these detectives driving 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours to come talk to me? It's got to be pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in prison for, in some of these cases, over 2 years.
So essentially you want to catch them kind of cold, right?
You want to catch them cold. And I think that's part of the strategy why. I could be wrong, but that's just my assumption.
All right.
So again, they've interviewed half of the people they wanted to interview. So next up, the Daniel unit, another Texas prison in Snyder, Texas. When they get there, that witness wanted no role, no involvement in providing any information. I think this guy lived up to the mantra of snitches get stitches. He wants nothing to do with it.
Or worse, yeah.
Well, yeah, in this case, worse, right? So now they're two for five. Last stop of the road trip was about an hour west of Snyder at the Smith unit.
All out in West Texas.
And they're going even further west here in a minute.
Yep.
And so Smith units in La Mesa. There, they spoke with 23-year-old Malcolm Griffin. After a six-hour interview, Malcolm Griffin told detectives all they needed to hear. Detective Bocher said, quote, basically, he gave us the series of events. He tied everything together. It was Griffin who broke the six-year-old case wide open. Now, if you remember, like we talked about, stop number one, detectives a few days prior, Bocher and Thornton, had hoped to interview an inmate in the Denton County Jail. But when they got there, they found out that he had been transferred. That is true. So detectives headed to another Texas prison in Amarillo to interview the last person on the list. The last person on the list was 27-year-old Julian Burt. Thornton, Bocher's partner, said, quote, "We told him exactly what occurred. He looked down and did not have much to say about it." So in breaking that sentence down, breaking that comment down a little bit, I think they took the strategy of, here's what we know. We know you're involved. And he offers no defense. He offers no explanation. That's what happens in these interrogations. When somebody's about to break, the head hangs. You could have a 27-year-old man who's suspected of murdering people have the same response that a 8-year-old or a 9-year-old would have for doing something wrong at home, right? Not making eye contact, not looking at you. So I think that's what happened. Week later, Griffin, Burt, and 23-year-old Anthony Furnell, went by the name Tony, were all charged with capital murder. However, one suspect remained. That suspect was 26-year-old Robbie Robinson. His days of freedom were short-lived as well. He was apprehended fairly quickly.
Okay, so let's back up a second. You mentioned an informant provided information. Do we know who that informant was?
I don't know if the guy that we're about to talk about is one and the same. But what we were able to find, one person who provided information, John Clay, went by the name Cold-Blooded. John Cold-Blooded Clay. In February 1996, Clay was busted in a long-term drug sting. It's believed that John Clay Jr., who pleaded guilty to drug charges, began doing what all informants do. What is that? He began telling on people. Clay was a treasure trove of information for law enforcement. So he gets busted in a drug conspiracy case. We talked about the arms of federal law enforcement waiting to embrace Mr. Clay. He decides, I don't know if I want this hug from the feds. I'm going to try to minimize this.
It's always about survival, right? It's not
survival.
It's not conscious that the conscious.
No, survival.
Mind that gets to you.
So this treasure trove, Clay helped police solve several crimes. And these aren't low-level crimes. Provided information on a dirty federal agent. Provided information on a parole officer who, that's going to be another story in and of itself.
All right.
But very corrupt, as the charges implied. Also had gang ties. The other thing he did, and you may remember this case, he helped police crack the case on the highly publicized murder of Lisa Renee in Arlington. She was murdered in 1994, apartment complex. Drugs were involved in that one. Believe she was recovered in Arkansas, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, we are talking...
This all does sound very, very familiar, and I can't put all the pieces together, but it sounds like something we should explore somewhere down the way.
Yeah, I mean, you were just a baby rider back then when this happened.
A baby.
And to top it off, Cold-Blooded also has some information on the glass key.
All right, so glass key. So how did he know about the Glass Key Cafe?
Just so happened that Clay's ex-wife, Marlene, was now married to Julian Burt.
It's a small world. So what surfaced after the case was cracked?
So we started to learn more about what happened on that May 14th, 1990 morning inside the Glass Key. So we learned the suspect known as the Wolfman, that was Julian Burt, the one who shot Satterwhite right below the eye, started circling the table, and just started shooting people. Mm-hmm. Robbie Robinson, the fourth suspect that was charged, he was the man who circled the table, that infamous pool table that Sergeant Foster talked about, that there's pictures of this pool table online. It's crazy. It's where they played their dice games. He was the one who circled that pool table, collecting the loot in the black plastic bag. Furnell, he was the guy outside, the lookout.
Who also killed somebody.
Who also fired the shot, killed a guy, and then hit the gas meter. And then finally, Griffin, he was the third suspect inside the Glass Key during those slayings.
So how much was taken? Did police ever figure that out as far as money?
Not exactly. It was a pretty wide range. The estimates were between $10,000 and $250,000.
That is a wide
range. It's a huge range. It's believed after the robbery, the four suspects went to a home where they split their ill-gotten gains. But law enforcement not knowing the amount doesn't surprise me.
Why is that? Just because cash is so hard to trace? Who knows?
Well, there would be that element, but remember, most, if not all, of the patrons at the Glass Key that got there on the evening hours of May 13th into the morning hours of May 14th, they're there partaking in illegal activity. Even today, and like we mentioned in the last episode, people that have a part in underworld activities, they're a little bit less inclined to cooperate with the police. This happens at game rooms or gambling dens like the Glass Key. Then, today, it also happens at dope houses.
What do you mean? What do you mean dope houses?
So, you know, when you're watching the news and you see the murder, three or four people were, there's a slaying inside of a house. Three or four people were shot and killed.
Right.
So in a lot of those cases, they're dope house robberies, just like the Glass Key was. Yeah. So basically a few guys kick in a door, start shooting. They steal the dope. They steal the money. They leave. Even if there is a survivor, like in these dope house robberies, he's cowering under a dining room table or whatever. Mm-hmm. He dodges the bullets. He escapes the gunfire. It's more likely he's running once the assailants leave. You know, kind of goes against the instinct of calling the cops.
Yeah,
why?
Kind of counterintuitive, yeah.
Yeah, counterintuitive. But again, even the survivor says, well, hey, I'm in this house. We're selling dope or we're doing whatever illegal thing that we're doing. I don't want any part of it.
Afraid of getting got.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's common, actually really common here, and I'm sure in other places across the U.S. You know, John, my favorite bar in West Fort Worth, little place called Oscar's Pub.
Never heard of it. Where is it?
6323 Camp Bowie.
Oh, I do know this place.
Yes. I have been told and have experienced they serve the best cocktails in West Fort Worth.
Pretty tasty.
And at a price that can't be beat.
Cannot.
And a staff that could not be more friendly.
Yeah. I'm telling you.
And when you walk in there, they made a show. They made a TV show in the early 80s, mid 80s. Very much a resemblance.
Heard about it. You're talking Cheers.
It's the exact same thing. You walk in.
Where everybody knows your name.
Everybody knows your name.
Telling you what. Also, it is a very friendly place. In fact, there's an order there. It says, or directive there. It says, be nice or leave. That's how friendly this place is.
And they mean it, too.
Oh, yeah, they mean it, too. And I'm telling you what else. Do not sleep on those tacos in that taco truck that sits right outside. Oh,
no, sir.
I've had tacos and burritos there. I think it's Gordo's taco truck out there, and it is...
Oh, they're good.
It is good. They're really good. I mean, even if you don't want to go... Even if you don't want to... Like tonight, I've got to go back to the office... And I'm gonna swing by there and not drink 1 ounce of liquor. I'm just gonna get a burrito.
Get a burrito.
Get a burrito and say hello to some people.
Get back in front of the keyboard.
Exactly. So. So Oscar's Pub, 6323 Camp Bowie Boulevard. Be there or be square. So back to what happened with the suspects in the Glass Key slayings. In October 1998, Fernell and Griffin plead guilty. Fernell pleaded guilty to 3 counts of murder and received a 35-year prison sentence. Griffin pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder and 1 count of capital murder. He received a life sentence for his role in the Glass Key murders. Later, Robbie Robinson, the man who collected all the loot from the table, received a 42-year prison sentence. And finally, Julian Burt. 13 years after the Glass Key murders, Julian Burt, the Wolfman, accepted a plea agreement for 2 counts of capital murder and 1 count of murder. Burt was already incarcerated on a 30-year prison term for another murder. For his role in the Glass Key, Burt was sentenced to life in prison. So after 13 years, the Glass Key slayings had finally been solved. And that seems like a long time.
Not under those circumstances.
And what exactly do you mean by that?
I'm beating a dead horse. Fort Worth had that infamous nickname.
Murderworth.
So we're talking late 80s, early 90s. Fort Worth was a nationwide leader. A leader in homicides. Not a great thing to be a leader in, especially if you're a per capita kind of deal. So you're talking back then 200 plus murders in a 1 year period, one almost every other day, a little more than. You know, we're not talking about a crime where cars are getting broken into or graffiti is getting sprayed on the side of a building. We're talking about people losing their life. And at the time of the Glass Key Cafe investigation, investigating murders, like we mentioned before, fell squarely on the shoulders of 9 or 10 detectives.
Doing 200 plus murders a year.
Yes.
All right.
Can you imagine if your day-to-day involves solving the death of another person at the hands of another person? I mean, that's a lot of work for 9 people. I mean,
chasing leads. Well, how many typically, obviously, witnesses might a detective talk to solve just one murder?
I mean, it's too wide of a range to give a typical number. I mean, because you
could be one, it could be.
Could be one, it could be 50.
50.
Right? Depends on where it happened. If it happened at a party and some drive-by shooting and there's 100 people at this party, they're probably going to get to talk to half, maybe, hopefully. It's still going to be a large number.
So you got to talk to 50 people, perhaps.
Well, now we have digital evidence. We have, I mean, the list goes on now. So, but here we are 30 years later. We're twice the population, give or take.
Yeah, getting close.
Close to it. Maybe twice the number of detectives, give or take. I'm pretty sure they're still a little bit understaffed for the severity of the crime, but that's not really a problem that we can solve or we're here to solve. Anyway, when we look at crime in the 90s, things had to change. This Glass Key thing happened at the height, when Fort Worth was bad. Mm-hmm. You may remember those days.
I remember this crime like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Happening.
It was pretty, it was popular back then. So, like I said, things had to change. So what'd society do to address the problem? Realistically, they took a tough stance on crime. That's where we started to see the zero tolerance approach to crime, your anti-gang programs, your longer prison sentences, and the list goes on. Crime slowed. I guess this worked. Overall, it's just a shift in the criminal justice system. Now, here we are 30 years later, and we hear the stories of the bad side.
Of the zero tolerance.
Of the zero tolerance, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, and I think that's safe to say, but I also think it's safe to say it is important to hold those accountable who victimize other people.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I don't.
Of course.
I think everybody in society is okay with that.
Absolutely. Well, another sidebar of an interesting stat you mentioned. By 1996, things had begun to slow down considerably in Cowtown. Maybe the zero tolerance was working after all. It wasn't long ago that the 9 homicide detectives could barely keep their head above water. But by August 1996, the city of Fort Worth had logged only 29 homicides, on pace for a 2-decade low. So this slowdown, these crime-fighting measures, if we go by the precious data that everybody wants to go by, we're obviously working.
Yeah, I think so.
And aside from the obvious, detectives could start working on older cases, and the Glass Key was one of those. It was one of 9 cold cases that had been solved that year.
Yep.
So with the 24 of the 29 murders in 1996 being solved and the cold cases that were being solved, Fort Worth PD homicide had a 113% clearance rate. That seems like success.
Even today's standards, I'm going to suggest, because I don't have any factual data in front of me to back this statement up, but I am quite certain one of the great things about living in Fort Worth, I bet you their clearance rate is higher, possibly significantly higher than your national average. We've talked about that before with the Blahitka case. And I think one of the things that we're going to see, and I think this is noteworthy, this will happen. So right now, and even back then, I didn't know Boettcher, but he was a homicide detective when I first got on. Right. I mean, he's one of those guys that was there for a long time. They also brought up in a lot of the research we did, Sergeant Kratz. I mean, these guys were like famous cops basically in Fort Worth, right? I mean, Kratz is in the newspaper all the time. And the cool thing is he always gave credit to his troops, the ones that worked for him. And he always made sure to highlight the good work that they did. Now, what I'm getting at with this, though. So we look at this homicide unit today, super high clearance rate, no doubt about it. We talked about, the tenacity that they have in the Blahitka case, it was our very first episode we ever did.
It was.
Yeah.
Pretty good one too. Just go back and
People need to go back and listen to that one.
If you haven't listened to it.
Now here's the interesting thing.
Worth a listen.
This is what I think will happen. So this is how
they're all worth a listen, actually.
Well, they all are.
But anyway, go ahead.
This is how money impacts crime fighting. So if you remember 15 years ago, maybe not 15, 10 years ago. Yeah, 10 years ago.
It's all disappeared.
Fort Worth PD pension has some issues, right? And they look at it and they say, hey, we're going to have to make some adjustments to this pension fund because I don't know that it's sustainable.
Right.
So what they did, they remove overtime from the equation. So how the system worked was under the old system, your overtime counted and you got a certain percentage of your total salary, including overtime. Well, I don't know that it was in trouble. I suppose it was in a certain level of trouble or they wouldn't have made any adjustments. They now said, hey, overtime no longer counts. You have to go off of your base salary. Well, in law enforcement, the only way you raise your base salary is by promoting. So in Fort Worth, you have officers. That's where you start. Then you go to detective. Then you go to sergeant, lieutenant, captain, commander, deputy chief, assistant chief, pretty top heavy, but it's not pretty top. It's a very top heavy organization, too top heavy. I'm going to go on record and say
hot sports opinion.
That's a hot sports opinion, but I'm going with it.
Okay.
And so,
and you say that because we need more people working in like this.
Yeah. You kind of need more people answering calls. You need more people, investigating crimes. You need more people directly supervising those investigative units. I don't know that we necessarily need more people riding a desk.
Is this our moment where we're announcing Jake White for city council?
No, God, no. Under no circumstances would that ever happen.
All right.
So
go ahead.
This is what I'm getting at. So these guys, so we talk about these detectives, they're hardworking back then, hardworking now. The clearance rate reflects that. But in a few years, the ones that are there, they're all gone. I mean, they're at the end of their career and they're going to retire. So what we get now, because of the way the pension system works, you now have to promote and you have to promote quickly. So you lose that level of subject matter expertise. So I think within the next decade, we're going to see a significant reduction in subject matter expertise. Now, this has been said.
Might already have, if you ask me. But
well, I think subject matter expertise in law, it not quite yet.
Okay,
we're getting close, but not quite yet.
All right.
I've heard this said. I'm a big believer in a large metropolitan area that you have to have certain people who are subject matter experts. Because who do you call? Right. If you're in a smaller agency, you can call the Texas Rangers. You can call the Tarrant County Sheriff. Fort Worth PD can't call Tarrant County SO and say, hey, can you help us out on this investigation? I mean, we're bigger. We have probably more money and the list goes on. But we're going to lose those subject matter expertise positions or the people that have those roles. But I don't know that that's a concern. It was said it's better to be a jack of all trades and a master of none than a jack of all trades and a master of one. I 100% disagree with that statement. The person, if the detective investigating a murder is not a master of that craft, that's not fair. You know, that person who was killed, that's somebody's wife or husband, son, yeah, daughter, the list goes on. You got to have your best of the best investigating it. But that's not going to be the case soon. And that's no knock on, no knock at all whatsoever on the cops that are there now, the ones who promote, but they have to keep climbing the corporate ladder. And what happens when you keep climbing the corporate ladder is, you know, and this is really relevant right now, you don't have a 23-year, 24-year, 25-year veteran detective investigating murders. Now, you may have a 4, 5, or 6-year detective or officer investigating a murder. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we heard something about today in terms of police tenure and the issues that can arise with police tenure. If you're not, perhaps.
Go ahead and explain. We're in the midst of the, you're talking about the Jefferson case.
We're in the midst of that trial. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was brought up was the Aaron Dean was a 1-year officer. Right. Now, everybody's got to start somewhere. I'm not,
right.
You know, that there's no, I can't think of a way around it. Maybe there is, I don't know, but I can't think of a way around that. But that's one of the issues that's been highlighted was there were 2 rookie cops working a area. I don't have the stats. I think it's safe to say that area has a reputation for having high crime.
Well, and that trial has been described as a high crime area.
Right. I don't have any stats to back that up factually. I'm just saying from a reputation perspective, that's it. It's known to have that little area near Evans and Allen to be a high crime area. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's brought up was you had 2 cops with 1 year of experience going to this call.
Right.
Well, I don't know that there's any way around that. You have to start somewhere. But this whole idea of police tenure, the problem's only going to get worse because, you know, this was obviously the most, what we're talking about is tragedy beyond all right, levels of tragedy. But when we're looking at people who have to be subject matter experts, because patrol officers are not subject matter experts. They're not really expected to be a subject matter expert.
They don't know anything. They just got out there.
Well, like the rookie cop, they don't know anything. They're working a traffic accident, you know, at 11 p.m. and then at 2 p.m. they're working a domestic violence and then at, you know, what, and the list goes on. I mean, there's a whole slew of things. But when you're talking about somebody who's taken another person's life, you have to put your best foot forward. And if your best foot forward is a detective who says, hey, I'm going to promote to detective, and I don't even know if I really want to be a detective, but I just have to keep climbing the corporate ladder
to increase my salary,
to where I have a pension that I can survive on. Mm-hmm. The motivation is not, hey, I'm here to solve murders. The motivation is, hey, I'm here to get a little bit higher of a paycheck so I can get the next higher paycheck. And that's tragic. And that's like I said, I think we're a decade away, perhaps even just a little bit less, from seeing the consequences of that. So does in return, does that trickle down? No. Right now, I don't know. I mean, but like I said, I do think that we're going to start to see significant issues that come from that. Because I am 100% in a big city, a proponent that you have to have subject matter experts. And that's going to be gone. Mark my words, that will be gone.
Is this a matter of the law of unintended consequences? Did people not see that this was going to happen, or that
no,
when
they didn't
when they changed the pension?
I think it is 100% an unintended consequence, but maybe they don't care. I mean that there is a possibility in that, and that
when you say they, you mean the public officials or. You don't mean the police.
Not the police. The decision makers.
Yeah.
In
public policy people.
Again, it's where you run afoul with the money aspect of public safety.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate because, you know, I mean, we're talking about this case, this Glass Key case. We're talking about detectives who, this Glass Key case wasn't their only case. I mean, Boacher, Thornton, all those guys, they probably had I mean, heck, they could have been working 20 cases at a time back. Well, I mean, on the law of average would suggest that they probably were working 20 cases at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got to have people that are passionate and motivated and driven to do what they do, not motivated and passionate and driven to think, well, I'm going to have to just promote again in 3 or 4 years so I can keep getting a higher paycheck. I don't know. It's frustrating. The one thing I wish Sean, our local resident expert, legal expert, was here.
Yeah.
Because I did. The one thing I wanted to talk to him about, you know, these were jailhouse confessions, more or less.
Right. Pretty much.
I think there's some pitfalls to those. I never was. We would get calls all the time to go down to interview somebody at the jail, and they would tell you outlandish stories. Why? Because they wanted their freedom. They were hoping, hey, if I say, you know, they're kind of throwing spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks. They might tell you about 4 or 5 dope houses and think, well, hey, if they hit one of them, get a big lick out of there, then maybe I get out of jail a little bit early. So they were, I don't know that I can't ever think of one time where I really put a whole lot of stock into them. And I'm going off of memory and I could be wrong, but I don't know that I would never use that as a element of probable cause, or certainly not a sole element of probable cause. So perhaps they're not even.
Of course, in this instance, we're talking about guys saying, yeah, I did this, right?
Yeah, this one is a little bit different. And I think the strategy, it's pretty rare that you're going to, from the investigative side, that you're going to show your cards, which is what they did with Bert. You know, Bert was the last one they interviewed, and they walked in and they said, hey, this is what happened. And he hung his head. So there's going to be few times, but that's the other thing about homicide detectives, especially the good ones. Interviewing people, interrogating people is a craft.
Mm-hmm,
uh-huh, right. Uh-huh. And even the good ones, even those seasoned, those really, really good detectives, like, they're very cautious because, you know, you could, in some circumstances, elicit a false confession. So the good ones, they know it's a tightrope and they know how to walk it. And I think that's what happened. I think the other thing kind of on this one, I did find this interesting. So 15 years later, June 2005, Star Telegram does one of their polls.
Right.
The quote, which crime would you choose for the Star Telegram's crime of the century? 2%.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this.
2%. Or 82 of the respondents voted for the glass key. Decent number. Kozlo murder, just above that, was 6%. And then...
The Davis murders had to have been somewhere in that.
If I'm not mistaken, that was number one.
Yeah, had to have been.
So one of these others you're probably going to hear about here coming up soon. So, but, you know, I think ultimately with this case, and we can kind of bring it to a close, but at the end of the day, hardworking cops... solved this crime, solved this case, no doubt. A tragedy for sure, but one that unfortunately didn't come as a surprise. Like we learned, I mean, this was a mecca, if you will, for underworld activity and
that
Fort
type of
Worth,
stuff.
And it happens.
So I think it's safe to say also that an adopted zero tolerance policy, which allowed, you know, some time to get on this, was also key.
Key. Now, I will say this. When we talk about zero tolerance policies, there's, when you look at, okay, this area has a crime problem, mm-hmm. there are issues that come when the police employ or deploy a zero tolerance yep. strategy. Are they effective? Clearly. Right? I think there's almost a direct correlation with the zero tolerance policies and some of the other programs. But the problem is, and this was once was something that I learned once several years ago. In fact, the guy who taught this, his name's Tim Longo. And if you there's the Virginia murders, the one that just recently happened.
Yeah.
He was on, I guess he's the chief of police up there.
Football players. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, in Charlottesville,
long time ago, I'll say a long time, 10 years ago, they had the other female student who was kidnapped.
Okay.
Just to put a reference on who said this, but he said, you can't treat policing or you don't want to, it's better to spearfish than netfish. Because what happens is if you flood an area with cops, you're going to get a bunch of little minnows in the net or people that don't even need to be in the net. Because if it's go down there, solve crime at all problems, and everybody's getting pulled over for every reason under the sun, well, now all of a sudden you're stopping you might stop a car for a registration that's been out for 6 months. The driver, guy or girl, has 6 traffic warrants for their arrest. Well, under this zero tolerance approach, they got to go. They got to go to jail.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard, you know, for something that trivial and
creates burdens.
Yeah. And I don't know that, you know, an expired registration and 6 traffic warrants is necessarily that's not a significant representation of a criminal, right? Yeah. So there is the strategy of spearfishing. Target an area, but go after the bad guys. Go after the ones that the community says, hey, this is the issue. And law enforcement as a whole, unfortunately, is not real good with that. Because again, the quickest strategy that they deploy is the net. Hey, 50 cops go flood this neighborhood and stop everything that moves. If they got a traffic warrant, take them to jail. If they got this, take them to jail. Fort Worth did a really good job. And I will give kudos to Chief Noakes on, I think it was last year or the year before, they educated the areas that they were going to, saying, hey, we are here and we're here. It is a show of, a show of force. I don't know how else to phrase it.
A presence.
There's a ton of cops down here. And this isn't we're scooping people up for traffic warrants and this and that, and the list goes on. Right. So, I mean, it would be nice if, you know, maybe the strategy was to learn to fish with a spear and get the ones that need to be caught, not the ones who don't.
Well, so. Isn't that kind of the definition of a police beat, where you're on the beat and you make these relationships and you find out that way who's the good guy and who's the not so good guy?
It was.
Yeah.
I don't think that exists now.
Right. Well, because, that's kind of what you're talking about though, right?
Well, that's exactly how it should be.
Right.
You should know under a police beat concept, you should know who you need to talk to and who you don't.
Right. The neighborhood's going to tell you.
They will. And, you know, and ultimately, you also know, I talked to this guy one day and everything's fine. I pull up to talk to him 3 days later because maybe it's a different call and he takes off running and things aren't fine. And you have this cat and mouse game for 3 or 4 years. So, you know, hey, if he's running, something's up. If he's not running, so, you know, you get to know the people that you're there to protect. And unfortunately, I think that concept has completely evaporated. I mean,
I wonder if anybody will ever get that back.
Oh, there's ways to get it back. And that's something, I mean, going back to this, you know, trial that's going on, this Aaron Dean trial that's going on right now, you know, I don't see how cities can't examine what they're doing to improve seniority. I mean, I think there's some strategies. I don't want to get too far off in the weeds on this because I don't know a whole heck of a lot about this case. I mean, I've watched, you know, a day or two of the trial, but I don't want to, you know, go just because I don't know enough about it. But, you know, I do know that it seems like back in my day speech, your bad shifts, your midnight shifts, your evening shifts, you know, your 2 p.m. to, well, back then it was 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. and 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. It wasn't full of a bunch of rookies. I mean, there were rookie cops on that shift, but you did have a lot of seniority on that shift. And why that went away, I don't know. I mean, there's a ton of specialized units now that just, and I mean, I was a guy that spent the vast majority of my career in specialized units. So for me to say that, I mean, it, you know, I, there's.
That does seem to be an issue that of not enough seniority on those late shifts.
Well, yeah, because now going back to this, the cops are expected to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. Yeah. We've talked about this before. Yeah. We've talked about the idea of, you know, the police all of a sudden having to be, you know, psychologist or psychiatrist or whatever, mm-hmm. however you want to phrase it. You know, a liaison to the homeless population.
Yeah.
And the list goes on.
I mean, supposed to be like a medical doctor who can do all, you know, who can.
Right. That's who says, hey, this behavior is abnormal. I mean, obviously the layman can look and say, hey, this compared to normal, this is not normal. But at the end of the day, when you start looking at these, you know, these mental health crises and things like that, I mean, it's hard for, you know, it's hard for the police to, and they certainly can't diagnose something. I mean, I suppose there's some strategies they can use to help or minimize. But I mean, again, when you expect them to be a jack of all trades and a master of none, now all of a sudden you've got all these people in these units when they need to be, you know, when I think it's better when at least some of them are out on the streets answering 911 calls.
Certainly. All right. Well, let's call it a night.
Yeah, we gotta wrap this up.
That's this episode of the Signal 51 Chronicles, part 2 of the massacre at the Den for Thieves, the murders at the Glass Key Cafe. We'll see you next time.
Real quick, while they're listening.
Oh, yeah.
On that YouTube app, I got to get down there and hit the subscribe button. Exactly. Get on our Facebook page. Hit the follow button. Like our posts on Facebook. I think some of them are pretty funny.
They are.
Make sure to subscribe on your preferred podcast platforms. And that is all.
All right. We'll see you next week on the Signal 51 Chronicles.
Roxo Media House.